This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we're here to talk about in this episode include...
Social Combat.
Pat Mooney.
Mid-80s Fantasy Film Essentials.
And Space Object 3i Atlas.
Well, I sure am glad President Cat greenlit the Catstronauts' mission to expand the International Space Station. I hear he signed the authorization by swatting a pen across the floor. True leadership right there.
Giant laser pointers in space? What's not to like? And even better, the space station has live stream cameras. Although, half the time it's just nose boops. Let's check how the Catstronauts are doing up there on the space station.
Oh man, there goes Waffles the pilot. He's off to see how many kibble bits can achieve orbit around his belly. A pioneer in snackodynamics, that cat.
Here comes the kitty technician, Blanket. Careful, Waffles. If he catches you clogging the air filters with crumbs again, then it's back to litter box duty for you.
Wait a second, Robin. Major Meowser just got a hair-raising transmission from HQ. Is that the new napping module on its way?
Yep, it's their first space station edition. Science Officer Pom Pom better know what to do, or there'll be a... catastrophe in 3, 2, 1.
Here she is, and she's sharpening her claws on the instruction manual. Well, it might accidentally flip to the right page with enough swiping, I guess.
Look at them working together. Waffles is keeping the station steady with his prodigious belly. Blanket is swatting at the module's fasteners like a feather toy. Pom Pom finally found the right instructions, and Major Meowser is, napping on them? Teamwork, by golly!
Hooray for the Catstronauts!
The space station is saved!
Until the next module arrives and starts another near catastrophe, that is.
Wow, managing your own space station with a crew of feline heroes. Now that's the life!
You know you can, Robin. The official Catstronauts board game is available now from Atlas Games. It's full of pawsome color art by the comic book's creator, Drew Brockington, and Catstronauts features cooperative play that's fun for all ages. Find out more at atlas-games.com/catstronauts.
Sounds like the Catstronauts board game is perfect for the whole family. Let's meet this stellar challenge by picking up the Catstronauts board game now!
The rattle of dice, the thump of miniatures, the crunch of Doritos, and the benevolent gaze of Peter Frampton coming alive welcome us once more into the gaming hut. And here in the gaming hut, it's a scene of argument, a scene of disputation, a scene of impassioned oratory. No, someone is not trying to get away with using the psionics rules. Instead, we're role-playing persuasion, and persuasion is, of course, a thing that we do every day, all day, in some cases, and therefore, of course, have no idea how it works in real life, and certainly have barely any idea how it works mechanically. Robin, you have thoughts on what we call, because we are broken people in this art form, social combat.
Right. Well, let me take a moment for me to defend the term social combat, even though I don't really love it, because it does one thing, which is it says the social interaction system is just as important to this game as the combat part, right?
That
yeah. The issue with making social interaction suspenseful and have a win or lose is that you've got to draw it out somewhat and have sallies. And so that sort of, you know, the posts and the reposts, as it were, kind of mirror a combat in a way. And they certainly say, at least in a trad game, hey, this part is also important. And if you want something that is as suspenseful as and important to the narrative as combat can be, it's not useless to call it social combat.
Right.
I still would prefer something else, like a persuasion contest, for example. But it does sort of set out the intent in a way that makes its goals clear. So it's not the worst term in the world.
Right.
But my thesis here is that, and the comparison with combat is very useful for this segment anyway, in that most of us really don't know how combat works, right? There are, with the exception, of course, there are many combat veterans who play and people who've, you know, trained in martial arts and so forth. But even they will mostly acknowledge that the way that fights appear in film and TV, and therefore what we're trying to emulate in games, is something different, something funner, more visual.
Right.
RuneQuest, famously, Steve Perrin designed that around SCA combat, Society for Creative Anachronism. And so you get hit in the leg a lot.
Yep.
in RuneQuest, because it has hit locations. But in general, those of us who are lucky and sheltered do not have combat as part of our everyday experience. We think, however, at least, that we have persuasion as part of our everyday experience. But mostly what we have is arguing with people who do not give in.
Right. Yeah.
So just like a fight, a scene where people argue and then come to a resolution or don't is going to have to be heightened to some degree, but it's also supposed to some extent mirror reality. It's closer to our realities. Talking to people and trying to bring them over to our point of view is part of our everyday experiences, as you suggest. But when you get people to play out a system where you're, you know, trying to rack up a number of persuasion points or not get your persuasion points whittled down before the other person's, I think the frustration of the way real persuasion works kicks in hard. And yeah. We could have an argument, probably even you and I could have an argument about how persuasion works, because
it could happen.
It happens constantly or doesn't happen. But how persuasion really works and how we want it to work, super different.
Well, we are not going to have that argument here. First of all, that would be a different hut. But second of all, the question of representing it in game, if I take your point, is that the disconnect between game mechanics and lived experience is higher when you're using a social system in a game than it is in other things in the game, like magic. None of us have ever cast a fireball. There's no way to say what that would or would not feel like. But we've all tried to talk someone into something, and sometimes we feel that that's wrong. I think one of the big problems is that most genuine persuasion happens over time and is therefore not dramatically suitable for role-playing. That you say something and someone says, no, that's never going to happen. I'm never going to do that. And then over time, either more evidence comes up or they decide that they want something from you or whatever happens. But usually it's, you know, days, weeks, months later, they say, okay, you were right. We're going to go ahead and do the thing you wanted to do. And maybe they don't even say that, but they wind up doing it. And that, of course, is a terrible thing to have to model in a conventional role-playing game. And even in most unconventional role-playing games, you're not swinging your decision matrix out by months from the original decision. I want to talk that king into hiring me to clear out the forest. No one is ever going to wait 2 months of game time for the king to make up his mind. That's ridiculous. And by the time the king does, you're off looking for a magic ruby or you're doing some other thing. And you're like, Forrest, that was 2 months ago. We're bored with that now. So the other problem is that in a similar fashion to let us just pick at random gunshot wounds, any note of realism ruins the game. So when you are trying to do realistic persuasion, you ruin the game and you have to sort of, as you say, do a cinematic, highly colored, fast breaking version of it and hope that you've buttressed it enough or made it a fun enough experience in play that players don't mind the disconnect any more than they mind the disconnect if you're doing wuxia martial arts, regardless of how often they've sparred at their local dojo, right?
Right. I would argue that people want persuasion to work in a game the same way they want it to work in real life, and that it doesn't work that way in real life, in that people want to just explain the thing that would make sense for you, the other person, to do, and the other person says, yes, that makes sense. And in a negotiation in particular, that is not the point, that what sways people is not being told what they ought to think. Famously, Republican senators were annoyed and bemused by President Obama, who would explain his position as if they were ever going to agree with it.
Right.
But they were not, because they had a different set of interests and a different set of, you know, basic core ideas about how things ought to be and who their patrons were and so forth.
Different
and
priors.
Right. They had priors, and they were annoyed by the fact that he continued to waste their time by explaining his point of view as if they were ever going to accept it. And so there's persuasion within people who essentially agree, and what an in-group agrees on can evolve over time, as you suggest, not in a way that's easily modeled in a game. And mostly when you can talk somebody who is in your group into something, you do that by appealing to group loyalty or by contrasting two separate values within that group's value system and arguing why this, you know, you believe two things. Here's the one of those things that should take priority now. That's, you know, basically the limits of persuasion. And anything beyond that stops being persuasion and becomes a negotiation, so that you say, well, we don't agree on this and our interests are very different, but here's what I can do for you. Here's how I can help satisfy your interests. There are various ways that that can work. Extremely charismatic people can sort of bend people toward thinking, oh, I didn't think this person was in my group, but he is in my group. And I didn't think he wanted what I want, but I guess he does want what I want. And so that's, you know, having a high charisma score, that's something you can model.
Or a high fast talk, as you suggest with that example.
Yes. Or, you know, so we break down in gaming quite often persuasion into a bunch of different skills, which enables everybody to have a specialty and everybody to take part in persuasion. So there's definitely a moment where, you know, oratory is a skill in some systems, and that's like stirring people emotionally. Well, those people have to be part of your group. Or, you know, there's a hard-knuckled sort of trading of interests. But essentially, the thing that doesn't really work is just you, the player characters, explain what makes sense to you and what you want without going to the negotiating table and saying, well, I can see what your set of interests are. Here's how I'm going to move toward them, rather than you should agree that it makes sense for you to do this. And here, let me roll a die and get a bunch of points for it.
I think we may be, and I'm hoping we are, out of the woods of, I'm never as a player character going to be talked into a thing I wouldn't ordinarily do. I'm hoping that at least maybe I'm being over optimistic, but in many genres of play, and having come off of doing the social combat for Vampire, it is imperative for those genres that thing happen, that you wind up agreeing against your will or against your better judgment or against whatever the player character might dig their heels in order to further the drama, in order to model the type of story you're telling, and in order for anything to ever happen. And I feel like similar decisions are being made in drama system where the player is maybe never persuaded, but they're thinking, well, I need to get more tokens, so I'll give in on this one, and then I can really dig my heels in on the important stuff, only to discover that everything's important stuff in drama system. So it is, again, the other situation, in addition to the reality check problem that we were talking about, is that the notion of my character is a little chess piece, and he's a solid piece of ivory, and he's my ivory, and I control him, and he never changes, is a very old and long-standing play structure, and it's hard to overcome even that settler effect in people because, of course, the very first thing that they learn in their first ever game is, this is my character, the GM is all the orcs and gibbons and things. And it's hard to sort of give up that autonomy that you've literally, is kind of the special thing about the art form, is that, no, I make the decisions for this guy. That's different from a novel or a movie or a cartoon or whatever, right?
Right. Getting players to agree to be persuaded is an even bigger ask, as you suggest. And I think still there are people who, if you create the context for it, as drama system does, people mostly do start to do that because they kind of have to. But in general, people in a more trad role-playing game, I think still are as happy about having to be persuaded and to acknowledge that they've had their minds changed as they are to be captured, right? Any lack of autonomy. And I think the frustration often is just even, you know, let alone the idea of you being persuaded, but the fact that other characters won't be persuaded by you simply explaining Obama style what they should think, I think is also frustrating for them. They want, I think essentially they want a conversational version of Fireball, right?
Well, there's an old joke that all grappling systems should be incredibly complex when the bad guys are grappling me and incredibly simple when I'm grappling the bad guys. And over and above all the other problems with grappling, which is actually not unlike structurally the problems with persuasion, everyone wants a way to get out of the confrontation. And whether that is I roll charisma and the guard agrees to let us pass, or I give him the Vulcan neck pinch and he drops to the floor and we pass. Everyone wants the Vulcan neck pinch, whether it be conversational or otherwise. And something about weapons coming out resigns people, I guess, to the formality of having to roll dice and fight for it. But in so many places, I feel like, and for good and bad reasons, because some people are like, it's not important what happens to this guard. What's important is what's on the other side of him, the real story. And some people are simply, no, I'm engaged in escapist power fantasy. I do not want to dicker with underlings. I have to do that in my real life. And they want to move through those obstacles in some way. And I feel like the design of a social combat system, which is more important in genre emulation and storytelling than grappling is, in most cases, is the bigger stumbling block. But you see that same stumbling block pop up in grappling arguments all over the internet as well. And again, grappling is something because of high school wrestling and everything else. Your example comes back. People have enough experience with it that they yell if the system doesn't model their lived experience the way that they want it to model it.
And so I think the solution is, when designing a social combat system, is to have crunchy bits, to have the, whether they're the literal spells mm-hmm. or they're the equivalent of, you know, moves in many different games where you have the, you know, the close the deal move, which you can make when you've got the person partly worn down, or you've got the, you know, turn on the charm move, or the to mechanize it more. So it goes beyond the player makes the argument and rolls and fails. That's very frustrating also because it's hard to think of six different arguments. Right. Because if you really want social combat to be the same as fighting combat, that means introducing more crunchy bits that they can mm-hmm. use in abstract so that it's not just down to their sense of verbal invention.
Or at the very least, making it a more granular, rather than one roll, it's the same number of rolls that you would have in a normal combat against that guy. So if he's got 18 hit points, he should have 18 willpower points. And then you have to, you know, scuffle with him as he makes your willpower go down, either just by saying, you can't go through this door, I'm a guard, or in a more elevated contest over who gets rights to the magic vineyard or whatever else the situation is.
Right. And you have to find a way so that that is not just repeating the same annoying experience 7 or 8 times until you run out of points, but that it feels like something is building and that you have at least a heightened fantastical yeah. or literary interaction. Well, speaking of talking to people, Ken, I think you're going to talk to someone else on the other side of this here commercial.
Sinister influences threaten to corrupt America from within and without.
The federal government establishes a new agency for overseas covert action.
The Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, the BNDD.
And within it, the forces of Delta Green.
In the Borealis Connection, the new globe-spanning mega-campaign for the fall of Delta Green, you become the mythos-hunting agents hidden inside the BNDD.
Play 8 linked operations.
As separate standalones.
Or linked into an epic hunt for an infamous target.
Escort a sniper carrying a death warrant for a Shan warlord.
Surveil a Saigon drug summit.
Track heroin couriers on a flight from Hong Kong to L.A.
Investigate the disappearance of an archaeologist working the Bozu Kepi ceremonial site.
Smash a Beirut drug deal.
ID the actors broadcasting the Necronomicon from a CIA backed Munich radio station.
And wage the drug war amid France's May 68 riots.
Designed by Kenneth Haidt.
Written by Gareth Ryder Hanrahan.
The team that brought you the Zelazny Quartet and the Dracula Dossier.
The Borealis Connection.
Gorgeously designed and horrifically illustrated by Jen McCleary.
A tale of sordid intrigue.
Cosmic horror.
And desperate action against the mythos.
Now available in Titanic hardback.
From specially cleared gaming retail stores.
And the Pelgrane Press web store.
Now also at the web store as an instantly available PDF-only purchase. Welcome once more to Ken and or Robin Talk with Someone Else. And today, I, Ken, am talking with someone else, specifically Pat Mooney of Flagbearer Games, a name perhaps familiar to you, the beloved listener, because they're a sponsor, which means that any sort of friendship or fellow feeling or admiration I express to Pat can be written off as craven self-interest instead of genuine artistic expression. And yet, despite that, you've agreed to come on the show.
I sure have.
So, welcome. Thank you so much for coming on, taking time out of a Gen Con setup. If people are wondering why everything sounds weird and echoey and maybe there's banging noises, it's because we are at Gen Con in the beautiful Embassy Suites in scenic downtown Indianapolis on a miserably hot day with no air conditioning. So, hurrah for all of that.
All the elements of success
right there. Exactly, right there. Yeah, when they say 99% perspiration, this is the simplest way to do it. Don't actually work, just be in Indianapolis in August. So, welcome to the program. Congratulations on Campaign in the North.
Thank you.
Coming out.
Yeah.
For those people who skip past the commercials, like communists, the game is Nations and Cannons.
That's, yeah.
And it is a role-playing game primarily focusing on irregulars in 18th century adventure settings. Is that a good generic term for it?
That's a good, I think what we usually run with is spies, scouts, and saboteurs, because everyone likes a good alliteration.
Right, yeah.
But yeah, the intent is for a kind of heroic fantasy that puts you in the position to look through the eyes of someone extraordinary on the battlefield in 18th century conflicts, particularly what we're focusing on at the moment is the American Revolution, and to give you a campaign to go on larger-than-life adventures, going behind enemy lines, achieving key objectives, and retrieving intelligence that might tip the scales of larger conflicts.
And so there's going to be two questions that anyone who hears about this game is going to ask, and one of these is the wrong question, one of these is the right question. The wrong question is there magic? And is there magic?
There is no magic.
No magic.
However, and I'm anticipating your next question, which is what is the rule set, right?
Nope. Sorry.
I'll jump
Feel free to jump ahead and give that, though.
So, Nations and Cannons sits atop the 5e D&D rule set. We'd like to call it an overlay in that way.
Uh-huh.
And you might be familiar with the fact that there are, in fact, elves and wizards in Dungeons & Dragons.
I've been told this.
What we've done is effectively use the same mechanics, but to strip out supernatural elements, right? So we're compatible with a lot of the base classes in the game that make sense in a mundane context. So your fighters, your barbarians, rangers, which typically get spells, and a new class called the Firebrand, which is our charisma-based Alexander Hamilton rabble-rouser type.
Right.
And so the Firebrand...
Bard, but cool.
Yeah. Well, in the new book, they actually get a new subclass called the Drummer. So they can use battlefield music to inspire their allies and communicate across long distances.
All right.
And a little bit of bardic inspiration up in there, too. But the idea being that the Fireman and the Ranger get access to gambits. Gambits, kind of, they work like the Artificer in 5e, where they are, the player is encouraged to flavor them in different ways, but they're tricks of gumption and derring do, battlefield tactics, elements of espionage, humoral medicine, making inspirational speeches, all this kind of stuff that really dives deep into aspects of the period. And those abilities are, they're not supernatural, but they are extraordinary, and they're meant to kind of reflect, you know, your training and your skill set as a partisan in a revolutionary cause.
So it's sort of a pulp or wuxia 1776.
Yeah.
Nothing overtly magic, but you're just more badass than anyone except Daniel Morgan.
You know, I hadn't quite thought about wuxia as a parallel, but that's not far from the mark. Basically, we position you so that, like, you know, by level 5 or so, you are analogous to Daniel Boone or Molly Pitcher, right? Like,
yeah.
You've got tall tales of your own that are being told about you on the battlefield.
And this is not the other question, but since you said tall tales, is there a glory mechanic a la Pendragon that
follows you around, or is that subsumed within experience points and leveling?
I think largely experience points and leveling, although we do have a couple systems that push getting yourselves, exposing yourself to enemy fire, heroic actions of bravery will reward you. Nations and Cannons is a lot more lethal than baseline 5e. The way we accomplish this is...
Because there's cannons
and black powder weapons, and the way that a musket works is your average brown Bess deals 2d8 damage. That's on the lower end of the musket line. It's quite a large amount of damage for a ranged weapon, but it's balanced by the fact that you have to take an action to reload it after you fire it.
Right? Yeah.
And so there's a lot of burst damage in the system, but it's still balanced against traditional 5e offerings, because if you divide that damage over the course of two rounds, it averages out.
Right.
And because there's lots of damage flying around, there's lots of opportunities for you to be heroic and defy danger in that way.
And so now the correct question
is,
are there either mass combat or small unit tactics rules in the game such that we're not just behind the scenes, but we could be like Sharp in Sharp's Rifles, to pick the perhaps best known example of this?
The two things people always go for is the Peninsular War and Sharp's Rifles and Naval Combat. These are both things that I wish I had fully developed rule sets I could sell you right now, but we have some prototypes, we are taking our time, and we want to do them justice.
Right.
What we do have is a lot of elements of wargaming in our DNA, right?
Yeah.
So while we don't have mass combat on a bird's eye scale of warfare, typically Nations and Cannons combat scenarios lean into the colonial ranger fantasy of bursting out of the woods, ambushing that picket of
redcoats
with your own heavily armed band, and then melding back in, and as part of that, being able to, as these elite partisans, take on forces that asymmetrically much larger than you, right? So the way that we accomplish this is the standard enemy is the footmen. The footmen, typically what they're going to be doing is making musket attacks or reloading their musket or stabbing you with a bayonet, right? But footmen have a number of abilities that trigger off one another. If a number of footmen are standing next to each other, they get a bonus. If there is a sergeant on the field, the sergeant can issue a volley fire, right? And that means that all of, it doesn't matter how many footmen you have that are participating in the volley, they have to be in a line, but then they all execute their turn simultaneously. Similar with things like cavalry charges, etc., right? What that means is you can have lots of enemy units on the field, but combat doesn't get bogged down by, having to go through the humdrum minutia, because their turns, execute quite cleanly. And it also adds an element of tactical flexibility that we quite like. You can disrupt the line by sending that barbarian charging straight through, which is going to have big strategic benefits. Or you can do what the Continental Sharpshooters did at the time. It's the origin of the term Widowmaker, so far as I've been able to research, and focus fire at that enemy officer.
Exactly. And so the notion that organized units are mostly the enemy.
Correct.
Very seldom is going to be you, that you're not going to be, even if you're Daniel Boone, you're still out there alone with your tomahawk and maybe your 2 to 7 friends. You don't have a team of 100 Shawnee warriors with you.
That's right. Yeah, we in our adventure design, we kind of lean into this fact that you are, these kind of commando units of the time, right, going off on these adventures that no one else can accomplish, oftentimes behind enemy lines. And in fact, in the American Crisis book, which is our new book, it's a full-length campaign, adventure campaign set from Bunker Hill through to Valley Forge. And one of the things we often do is have players, when they're causing chaos and ruckus in enemy-occupied cities like Boston or New York City, we have an alert system. Think of it like Grand Theft Auto a little bit, where the more you push the envelope, the more British patrols are going to escalate.
That's exactly the mechanic that I borrowed for Heat in Knights Black Agents.
That was
the alert system in Grand Theft Auto.
One of our major influences. So
right.
Thank you for your pedigree of strong work.
You're right. So Robin, in the notes to this, when he mentions that you're the interview, the last interview, he says, how will you be able to fill 15 minutes talking about American Revolutionary role-playing? And on the one hand, yes, okay, fine. But on the other hand, how can we fill 15 minutes? I mean, I feel like the thing about the American Revolution specifically, maybe, and certainly 19th century, no magic, but still fantastical action, that's got to be a bit of a sell. We are not in the glory days when I can play Daniel Boone is enough to get people to buy the game. What's your approach to, let's not even bring foreigners into it, who are beneath contempt in July at least. What's your sell to people who are either they don't know the revolution or they're like, well, I think that might be problematic or whatever. How do you move them from a position of being, well, I don't want to say ignorant, but let's say
on the fence.
To, you know, joining up.
So this project was really born out of a deep and abiding love for American history and the study of civics.
Right,
which has never been more important than today.
Absolutely.
A couple of things that I always like to point out. Number one, Nations and Canons is and never will be, or is not and never will be, a jingoistic product, right? This is not about rah-rah glorification, right? So often, things that use the term patriot or work within that milieu lend themselves to. We have adventures where you are alongside the patriot cause, but that doesn't mean we're afraid to criticize the patriots or the British or anyone. Anytime you have a war, there are atrocities, there are all sorts of details that often in contemporary retellings or historiography get glossed over. And I think role-playing can be at its strongest when it's dealing with these sorts of deep and uncomfortable scenarios. So there are NPCs in the book, there are lots of instances in our adventure campaign where we face facts with the stark reality that there was historical racism, right? That,
well, I mean, there was historical slave owning by a good chunk of the command structure of the American forces.
And our goal from a adventure design standpoint, and we've been very careful whenever we sit down to tell a story, is to never align your interests, the missions that you're going on, with the interests of oppressors.
Right.
You're never taking your marching orders from a slave master, right? We categorically disavow that. And to really allow anyone to play any character they are with agency in the past.
Mm-hmm.
One of our guiding principles is, again, this is everyone's history. And so we have a suite of pre-made characters that are available on our website, and we can download. And in the American Crisis campaign, we even have what I think is a pretty innovative mechanic we've designed called Key Moments, where we can, in each of these scripted adventures, spotlight the historic contributions of a particular character. And these are often, you know, black or indigenous characters or women who are not prominently featured in the pop culture consensus or understanding of the American Revolution. So we want to give you the opportunity to play those characters, to be heroic in the time, and to sort of confront some injustices.
Well, again, we have opened up a seam we could be talking about for 15 minutes, 25 minutes, however long. But I want to sort of pull it back to you and your road. I mean, you'd say, you know, fascinated by American history, all people should be, into the importance of civics, obviously vital. But what part of that said, now I will adapt Dungeons & Dragons 5th edition for this? Why is game design the way that you're approaching this, as opposed to angry screeds on the internet that accomplish nothing?
So I have a frank and honest answer for you, which has been a long time coming. But really, it's because I'm autistic and these are my special interests.
Right, okay.
And I smashed...
They didn't have trains, but they had the next best
thing. Yeah, I took the peanut butter and chocolate, and I smashed them together by sheer force of will. But games have always been extremely influential, right? The thing that I love, you know, wholeheartedly about TTRPGs is the creation of the magic circle, right? Is the ability that I can enter a story and be swept away and have, you know, creative decision making and be able to experience all of these things that you know are sometimes difficult for me in day to day life, and you know, doubling that with my work as an educator, we have a strong educational mission for Nations and Canons. And you know, one of the things I wanted to just quickly say is, as part of our nonprofit branch, we will give away a free copy of our core rules book to any school, you know, home teacher, museum, what have you, that contacts us, because we want to get this out there. When I was a kid, I always liked history, but there were things that I didn't get about it, right? Because I was reading facts and figures and dates and memorizing things, and I was never in a world where I could understand the choices that were being made and the context behind those things. And that's something that I found through my love of role-playing games. And so this project now is an attempt to bring the past to life, warts and all, to give students the ability to fall in love with that material and to really lean into all of the fascinating, you know, corners of the 18th century. When I mentioned civics, there's, you know, beyond the battlefield stuff, there's so much that happened during the 7 short years of the Revolutionary War that still, you know, has enormous impact today, right? And the more that we can position students to be able to dive into that material, to get passionate about it, then we have historians in the making. And then I've passed the torch forward.
Right.
That's something that I'm really passionate
about. Pass the curse on. Yes. Obviously, it's a story that never gets old. And in addition to all the sort of important educational aspect, there's also, you get to Tomahawk Redcoats almost magically in a adventurous and pulpy fashion. So you have that going for you. And as far as I'm concerned, yeah, I hadn't even thought of where are your naval combat rules, but John Paul Jones, my friend.
Oh, they're coming.
They're coming.
They're all right.
So with that promise of future ads read by me and future excitement to be had by you, I think that we will go into a commercial, maybe if we're lucky, a commercial for Flag Bearer Games. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having us.
In the spiral.
Four scenarios embrace the works and deaths of agents between 2016 and 2020, years called the Spiral and the Delta Green Campaign, God's Teeth.
That span of cruelty and corruption in American government seemed a bitter interregnum.
A momentary eruption of spite.
Now it stands revealed as a preparation for revelations to come.
In God's eye, a baffling disappearance leads the agents to confront the inexorable government panopticon.
They face unnatural revelations unleashed by the death of privacy.
And must survive desperate revenge beneath the sleepless skies.
In God's breath, a Delta Green friendly leaves a frantic voicemail about a Denver prisoner vomiting up an alien worm.
Your agents must identify the unnatural threat.
Trace it to its source.
Burn it out.
Just be careful of the smoke.
In God's law, a shockingly gruesome death leads the agents to a Los Angeles police gang.
It has twisted older, deeper laws towards the tired avarice of corruption.
How far do the agents go to resist the unnatural?
In God's light, the wreckage left by a mass shooter catches Delta Green's attention.
Somehow behind it, a surprising app that reaches strange places on the border between worlds.
The scenarios of God's Hunt are playable with Arc Dream Publishing's Delta Green, the role-playing game.
Play the scenarios on their own, as a cycle, or as a perfect companion to the acclaimed campaign Delta Green, God's Teeth.
Learn more about Delta Green at delta-green.com.
Argue for the continuation of this podcast by joining such beloved Patreon backers as
Chris Doyle,
Daniel Markwig,
Ian Carlson,
James Stewart,
and Jamie Twine.
The whir of the projector, the smell of the popcorn, and the feel of that weird stuff under our feet as we make our way to the center seats in the center aisle welcome us once more into the cinema hut, where we're settling back down for the mid-80s range of the Fantasy Film Essentials Film Festival. Yes.
And when you say mid-80s, it is the mid-80s is very mid, in my point of view. What? And I teased this a bit last week, but attentive viewers with your list of fantasy films of the 80s, we'll notice there are things that we don't mention because neither of us is willing to step up and declare them enough of a masterpiece or even a cornerstone of the genre to be worthy of mention. So get your, I can't believe you didn't mention that fingers ready, because this is the Fantasy Heartbreaker Edition,
right,
where some things that you may have seen, perhaps while somewhat younger than us, are going to go without mention.
They are
going
to be shoved to the wayside.
Right. And I think it's that 80s thing of the 80s vibe, which we're going to discuss also in reference to some films that we are mentioning. There's an element of the twee that sneaks in and I think makes some things not so great. Or just as we're getting closer to what we now think of as traditional or a high fantasy, the tone has some issues, or the faces of the puppets have some issues. So
right.
There are things here that we will shock you by not mentioning.
Right. But first, we're going to shock you by mentioning another movie about ghosts, because they're not gone yet. And this specific movie about ghosts is a Carl Reiner classic, one that I think is buried a little bit by his other great, great films. But it's All of Me from 1984. Robin?
Yes. And before I get to it, I'll also say again, if we were covering Wuxia, we'd also be mentioning Choi Hak Zoo Warriors. But as mentioned previously, that's another category of fantasy film.
Yep.
All of Me by Carl Reiner, at the time, was kind of acclaimed as his sort of more respectable, classy collaboration with Steve Martin after The Jerk and after his Dead Man Don't Wear Plaid, which was not seen as unclassy, but was sort of hard for people who weren't steeped in film noir to follow. This was their big, super mainstreamy hit. And the only reason I think that's fallen from the radar is just it was unavailable on video for a long time. But it is a brilliant resurgence of the ghost comedy, which brings a new premise in that Lily Tomlin, who is the rich and demanding client of sleazy lawyer Roger Cobb, as played by Steve Martin, she arranges a ritual where her body will die, but her soul will go into the fresh new body of a willing cultist. But things go awry, and it sort of halfway goes into the body of Steve Martin, who is not happy to have a ghost half controlling him. So it's got a screwball comedy premise, screwball comedy characters transposed to the 1980s, and a brilliant physical comedy by Steve Martin as he is playing someone whose body is being half controlled by a ghost.
And the number of times, I mean, I saw this in the theater with my buddies, and my buddies were the same fantasy nerds as everyone else's buddies in the 80s. And we spent maybe a calendar year saying, "Edwina, back in bowl," to each other, because it was just a hilarious movie. And, you know, Steve Martin, this is at the, you know, first height of his powers. He's sort of been bouncing along the top tier for a long old time. But everything you say about his physical comedy is great. It's Carl Reiner, a master of comedy for his whole career, and certainly no less masterful in the 80s than in the later Carl Reiner fantasy classic that we're definitely going to get to. Yeah, it's a best of breed comedy, and it is a shame that people sleep on it. But you shouldn't, and it is essential.
Next, we're going to come to an item that I had to check and make sure that we didn't talk about it in the horror essentials. We're going to talk about it anyway, even if we had, but turns out we haven't. And that's Ken, The Company of Wolves from 1984, directed by Neil Jordan.
Yeah, this is based on the Angela Carter short story, The Company of Wolves, which is sort of a cool, feminist, psychoanalytic retelling of Red Riding Hood. Angela Carter, one of the absolute doyens of horror. And this is her fairy tale, and it is weird, it is messed up, it is deliberately artificial in the way that I'm beginning to believe that I kind of like my best fantasy to be, and it is compelling watching. Angela Lansbury, of course, is Granny. Sarah Patterson is Red Riding Hood, called Rosaline in this. David Warner is a creepy father figure, as shows up in a lot of Angela Carter stuff. And of course, the late, great Terrence Stamp makes maybe the single best cameo appearance in the history of the genre when he drives into this fairy tale in a big white limousine as the devil. And my buddy and I are watching this film a few years back, and when that happens, it just turned the whole movie up to 11. It was a fantastic moment in a really remarkable, and I would say remarkably successful, attempt to capture what it feels like to be in a fairy tale in a film, because it doesn't feel like a magical idyll. A proper fairy tale feels scary and messed up, and you don't know what's going on because literally anything could happen. And that's what Neil Jordan does with this relatively conventional sort of werewolfy sort of fairy tale-y story. But his directorial and cinematic vision really make it pop on the screen and in your head.
Yeah, there's nothing twee going on here. There's nothing where you look at and go, well, that's so 80s.
It is sort of so 80s, given that it feels very music video-y a couple of times. But
it has control of its tone, certainly one of the great werewolf transformation images in cinema. And as we mentioned, sort of straddles the boundary between horror and fantasy, but it's a fairy tale, so we're mentioning it here. Speaking of mentioning things, here's where we break everyone's heart by neither of us being a huge Miyazaki fan. Nausicaa Valley of the Wind comes out at this point. I don't even have an argument against Miyazaki the way that I did against Dario Argento in the horror section. I see his films and I think, oh, I see why people really like these. So, sorry guys, not a Miyazaki fan hugely. But speaking of directors who know how to construct a story and put it together, Ken, we're going to talk about Lady Hawk by Richard Donner from 1984, where there is a little bit of a twee 80s element, but Richard Donner is there to counteract the spirit of the times.
And he does it, I think, by keeping the emotional through line very, I don't want to say melodramatic, but very intense. It's twee, it feels sort of distanced and medieval-y, but also these people are going through some stuff, and the acting, not least by Rutger Hauer as the guy who has to turn into a wolf by night, Michelle Pfeiffer as the lady who has to turn into a hawk by day, hence Lady Hawk, that really, I think, sells the piece. And Donner is a dark enough director, I think, instinctively, that he sort of balances or weights or whatever I want to say, the material, which is straight up medieval fairy tale vibe. And then, of course, we have Matthew Broderick in one of his many great 80s roles as the thief who interferes in this magical standoff to good effect at the end, we hope.
Right. And a lasting model for rogues and thieves in role-playing games. As you suggest, this has a sort of dark sort of, this is a fairy tale, a made-up fairy tale, but one that happens in a sort of rough-hewn medieval environment, and it almost veers out of its tone, but Donner keeps it on track, and therefore Lady Hawk earns its status as a fantasy essential. The next one, I think, is unquestionably an essential, except there's a giant asterisk, of course, next to the name of the filmmaker, because we're looking at Woody Allen's Purple Rise of Cairo. This is the film in which Jeff Daniels' movie character from a sort of a thin-seeming 30s archaeological melodrama steps off the screen and enters the life of real-life movie lover Cecilia, played by Mia Farrow. This, of course, causes all sorts of chaos, not just in Mia Farrow's marriage to her husband Monk, played by Danny Aiello, but the universe in general, and especially to the movie studio, who does not like the fact that this film is continuing to play with one of the characters having left the screen. The actor who plays the character, also played, of course, by Jeff Daniels, Gil Shepard, shows up to try and reduce the chaos and, of course, merely increases it. It's a beautiful homage to the love of cinema and the magic of cinema, unquestionably a fantasy film of just taking a completely improbable premise and playing out all of its comic consequences.
It certainly is all of that, I will say, about Woody Allen in his post-Sleepers era. And speaking of mentioning things, if we were covering Wuxia, this is where we'd talk about Big Trouble in Little China, an absolute essential of any genre you care to name, quite frankly, and a timeless classic that only gets more timeless.
But let's talk about something that is very much of its time, very much of the 80s. Ken, you're going to sing the praises, not as well as Freddie Mercury did, of Highlander by Russell Mulcahy from 1986.
Again, I think there are two kinds of people in this world, people who love Highlander and people who are wrong. Highlander is a movie that should not work on any level. It has the not particularly great acting of Christopher Lambert holding it down. He's also not a very convincing action hero. Sean Connery famously plays an Egyptian for some reason.
With a Spanish name, just to confuse the whole accent issue. Yeah, Christopher Lambert is Scottish, doesn't sound Scottish.
Right, Sean Connery. We have a Belgian Scot and a Scottish Egyptian who's Spanish. I hope that's clear for everyone. Fortunately, Clancy Brown literally is a Scythian warlord, so that really works out. He plays the Kurgan, the evil immortal. For the nine people who have not seen this movie, it is a war between immortals, and the immortals, when they meet, they fight, and one has to behead the other to kill him, and when he does, the amount of immortal power is concentrated ever further, and so the notion is that all the immortals are living down the centuries until at the end there can be only one, and there is a moment where the film lampshades its own ridiculousness. A character, the love interest, Brenda Wyatt, who is for some reason a metallurgy expert, shows up and says, "This sword makes no sense." Everyone's like, "Yes, yes, but we need swords. Moving on." And so it is a masterpiece of taking feel and energy and turning it into cinema, not at all hindered by a banger Queen soundtrack and another, much like Flash Gordon, where they sort of wrote it on an off day and said, well, that's done. And of course, it turns out to be an all-timer. It is a transportive film in the best tradition of the cinema. The fact that it is not actually particularly good and is, I think, almost irrelevant to this discussion because it does everything great cinema does also. It just does it with the somewhat large handicap of making no damn sense and starring a block of wood. So I'm going to say it. And it certainly has been essential in terms of feeding its energy and its vibe and its sort of story setup into the mainstream of fantasy. So it's essential in that way as well.
And as the first thing in a long running franchise, and I'm pretty sure there's another one on the way. There's a reboot.
Yes.
There can only be one. Does not apply to reboots of the franchise.
So far, frankly, it does, but we'll see. I mean, who right. can say?
Anyway, yes, it's a big fistful of 80s cheese, but I guess the way that it celebrates and or triumphs over that is, I guess your passion has won me over. We'll put it in the,
there we go.
In the pantheon. Look at that. And on the letterbox list. And on that note, we will adjourn, and next week we'll have things pick up a bit at the end of the 80s. The British are coming! The British are coming!
In Flag Bearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated in Nations and Cannons, you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
The new campaign guide, The American Crisis, War in the North, covers the early actions of the war with historical adventures, setting information, and a fiendish Hessian plot.
Nations and Cannons is 5e compatible and focuses on unconventional heroes from underrepresented perspectives.
Educators can get a copy of the core book for use in the classroom absolutely free.
The American Crisis is now fully available in print as well as PDF.
Visit nationsandcannons.com to check out a free adventure chapter and the quick start guide.
It's time once more to enter that most ill-defined of huts, the one where we're not really sure what's going on because there's a guy with a weird map over in one corner and he's arguing with a guy with a weird chronology, and then there's there's a perpetual motion machine making a weird noise over here. But, oh, if we look out the window, we can hear the scream of the alien big cat, and that means that the Nordic alien and the gray alien are having a kombucha over in the corner. And this time, I think the gray alien has a little enigmatic smile on his face because we're back in his territory of weird space things to discuss 3i/Atlas, which is an object that is hurtling toward us even as we speak. It's a new object. It's not, you know, the couple of years ago object of Umama. This is another interstellar rock, which Harvard theoretical physicist and astronomer Avi Loeb claims that it might be extraterrestrial technology and we ought to do something about it. So, Ken, why don't you tell us a bit more about a 3i Atlas?
3i Atlas is so-called because it is the third interstellar object found, and it is Atlas because it was discovered on July 1st by one of those desperate acronyms that fills astrophysics, the Asteroid Terrestrial Impact Last Alert System. Impact has a small I to prevent it being Atlas and making no sense. This telescope, one of the 5 networked globally, is in Chile, and it found 3i Atlas because 3i Atlas came in from the southern celestial hemisphere as opposed to the northern celestial hemisphere, where we expect most things to come for some reason. 3i Atlas is a comet. It's moving 58 kilometers per second relative to the sun, which is very fast for an interstellar object and for a comet. It entered the solar system, by which we mean the Kuiper Belt, around 6000 BC. It will come closest to the sun on the 29th of October this year, And that will be between Earth and Mars orbit. It will be within 270 million kilometers of Earth, because Earth will be on the other side of the sun when it passes that close.
Right. So 8,000 years of hurtling
indicates
just how long a hurdle it is to get through the solar system.
Well, I mean, entered the solar system by now means like a light year out. So it's not like it passed Pluto's orbit in 6,000 BC. A lot of that is spent out in the Oort cloud and whatnot. Anyway, it comes from the thick disk of the Milky Way in the direction of Sagittarius, which I think just means from the direction of the Milky Way. Sagittarius is the direction of the center of the Milky Way. It's between 7.6 billion and 14 billion years old, they estimate. Probably under a kilometer in diameter, although it's a fuzzy snowball, so it's hard to say what diameters. The high-end estimate is like 5 kilometers, but we'll see. And this is a comet that is on a hyperbolic orbit, and it is going through the solar system. So it's going to go on this way back out again, not like a fun comet like Halley's Comet, where we get to see it every 78 years. This is a one and done for 3I Atlas.
Right. It's just passing through. It's going to give us a little wave. And the fuzzy snowball you mentioned, it's because there's a nimbus of gas and dust given off when it's heated by the sun. And now that we're going to get to the questionable part that puts this in the Elliptony hut, that has led at least one person to say it's not a comet.
Right. And that person is a Harvard astronomer. He used to be chair of the Department of Astronomy until 2020, but he's still the director of the Institute for Theory and Computation at the Center for Astrophysics. So still a big deal. Abraham Avi Loeb, and he published a preprint on the 16th arguing that 3I Atlas is extraterrestrial technology. His argument,
and that's the 16th of this July.
Of this July, yes. He argues that it is fast and sneaky, that it has fewer volatiles than most comets. He argued this, by the way, at a time when it was impossible to tell how many volatiles it has because it was too far away. He says it will make close passes by 3 planets and then avoid the Earth, and that seems sus to him. And there is no other evidence in his preprint for anything extraterrestrial going on. And so Chris Lintott of Oxford, another university, speaks for the field when he calls Loeb's theory nonsense on stilts.
Yeah. University of Sydney radio astronomer Dr. Laura Dreesen is looking out for us, Ken, because she's trying to preserve the fun of this story while shooting down this ridiculous theory. And she calls it a really fun space rock. So everybody remember, even if it's not alien technology, it's a really fun space rock.
It's a really fun space rock.
I think it's holding a margarita.
So, well, it is by now because it's getting warm, right? Getting towards the sun.
Yep.
Loeb, even in that preprint, hedges his bets, saying the most likely outcome will be that 3I Atlas is a completely natural interstellar object, probably a comet, to which every other astronomer is saying, yes.
That's what we said. It's really fun space rock.
But it's interesting. It's an interesting exercise in its own right, and it is fun to explore whether or not it's interstellar technology, irrespective of its likely validity, which, again, is what most astronomers say. That's not science anymore. That's just some other thing.
Because he's just asking questions about this really fun space rock.
Likely validity is kind of the point of the exercise.
Yeah.
Now, Loeb has something of a rep of calling things extraterrestrial, and longtime listeners may remember him starring in our Oumuamua episode 406, because he said that that asteroid was also a spaceship because it looked like a cool rocket or maybe a flying saucer. And he's right about it looking like that. Probably not right about it being a spaceship, but it's, you know, on its way out. We'll never know. He made a similar claim for a meteorite named CNEOS 2014-108, which means it hit the Earth on January 8th, 2014, and it hit the ocean northeast of Papua New Guinea. In 2022, the U.S. Space Command said that their tracking data would not rule out an interstellar origin for this meteorite. Other people don't even think it's an interstellar meteorite. And most scientists say the Space Command data isn't good enough to make those decisions. And that, of course, is because the Space Command good data are classified. They don't show you all the really good imagery they have. That would defeat the point of having Space Command.
Well, the fact that they're keeping me a secret proves, Ken, proves sinister intent.
That it's aliens. So Loeb in 2021, again, after our episode, founded the Galileo Institute, so named because it's, you know, standing up to orthodoxy, to image UAPs, which is what UFOs are called now that they're fancy, to seek out interstellar objects entering the solar system, and to search for what he calls ETC, extraterrestrial technological civilization, either as artifacts in this system or in extraterrestrial imagery. So if you see an exoplanet and you see a metal moon around it, you can say, that's no moon. And then everyone high fives each other there at the Galileo Institute. And in a fun side note, he was had a big bug in his ear about CNEOS 2014-18 and wanted to recover the meteorite to find out whether or not it's extraterrestrial. And so he did his own data of the site, and he got a magnetic sea sled out, and it floated around in the ocean, and they pulled up some nodules, and he said, look at these metal nodules. These are clearly from an alien spaceship. They're multi-billions of years old. And other scientists said, can we look at those seismic data? And he said, sure. And they said, oh, this is a truck. That wasn't an impact. We don't know what you pulled up. Probably stuff from a boat that sank somewhere entirely different. So once more, Avi Loeb is a lonely figure on the ramparts of astrophysics. Whether he's on the ramparts looking out or looking in, I guess, is a matter of opinion.
Right. Well, he's definitely in the Elliptony hut and not in Fun with Science.
Right. And I do want to remind people that Harvard, people think Harvard University, I do want to remind them it is a reputable university. It's easily one of the best in Eastern Massachusetts. So
right.
No making fun of Harvard is allowed here.
It's no Oxford or University of Sydney.
No.
So the whole thing of there's a meteor coming to Earth and it's an alien vessel, we've covered this a whole bunch of times as a possible fun scenario, so let's not just repeat that. But I think the additional detail here in this story is about the getting the nodules up from the seafloor, because that, first of all, the nodules are here.
Right.
And they can therefore be the MacGuffin. And so it could be, you know, just the proof of alien ships that have fallen into the wrong hands that causes the adventure, and you have to protect the nodules from being captured by the men in black, or you are the men in black trying to get the nodules away from people who are going to misuse them, perhaps by putting them into the pattern that summons the aliens to come and attack us. We don't want that. Or just using their alien tech powers to do something that we don't want them to, like creating some sort of reality shattering bomb or some other, you know, turning the MacGuffin into the threat that you've got to neutralize at the end.
Yeah, the nodules are definitely, and they could be either the center of your story or they can be the backstory of your story. You know, how did we get this cool anti-gravity spaceship? Well, eccentric billionaire Wayne Bruce built this cool spaceship with a nodule that he bought from the Galileo Institute, which he has been funding in order to find more nodules. Or maybe the U.S. Space Command has got most of the metal from the meteorite and they're building their own world dominating craft. And, our heroes are, you know, they just have a couple of nodules that are in Britain or Harvard or somewhere like that. And they have to figure out, is there a weakness to this new exciting craft? And do we actually want to destroy the craft if, in fact, there are aliens sending creepy comets to spy on us? Perhaps the U.S. Space Command is Earth's only line of defense? ?
Right. And so that could be, if you transpose that away from just a strict aliens or possible aliens in the present day scenario into the esoterrorists, the meteor could actually be from the outer dark. They've briefly managed to pierce the veil far away from Earth and get this into the ocean. So you want to avoid this, somehow neutralize this form of power that powers the outer dark entities. In fall of Delta Green, it's too early for that particular nodule, but, you know, meteorites fall all the time and people weren't tracking them quite as much.
And meteorites with weird metal signatures that people argue about, we know what that means, color out of space-time. So maybe there's something going on in the water off of Papua New Guinea that needs to be looked at by Delta Green in the modern day, or whoever your mythos hunting people are, with or without a benevolent billionaire backer.
And if you're doing the alien vampire version of Knight's Black Agents, this could be the harbinger, the thing that creates the virus that selects people with certain genetic properties to be vampirized and to communicate together in a hive mind and form the conspiracy, if you want
or the vampires could dominate astrophysics and have kept everyone ignorant of this alien threat, except for bold vampire hunter/astrophysicist Abraham Loeb, who is the only person who knows the truth of the alien vampires, and these metal nodules are like the Silver Surfer showing up to let us know that the alien vampires are now ready to reinforce their beachhead, which was put on Earth at Roswell or wherever else you want to pick.
And, right. Well, maybe he doesn't even believe that the incoming space object is a spaceship, but he knows there are people out there who have a Google alert for it. And once they look at his paper, he can track them back and see if they're vampires waiting to see if this is the one and then go after them. So this
that the paper is actually a false flag meant to draw out the vampire conspiracy. A cunning wheels within wheels, even for a Harvard professor.
Right. Well, on that note, having come up with four or five different story hooks, it's time for us to declare this edition of Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff over. But I bet there'll be another one a mere 7 days from today. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Pelgrane Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dork Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/KenAndRobin.
Protect this podcast from ambiguous space objects by joining such backers as
Mark Kinney.
Michael Kuehl.
Neil Kaplan.
Oren Gashuri.
And Paul and Cleo Bush.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken and Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Grab our latest design. Subtlety is for people who forgot their battering ram.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindlaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when once again, we will talk about stuff.